The author and scholar Phyllis Tickle has famously surmised that about every 400 or 500 years, the church undergoes categorical changes, a reshuffling that she likens to a really big rummage sale. We put everything out on the driveway to see what works and what doesn't. In the 4th and 5th centuries, it was the effects of becoming the state religion of the Holy Roman Empire. Then it was the Great Schism in the 11th century. Later in the 15th century and 16th century was the Reformation. And now we are in the midst of what some are calling the Great Emergence. In every one of the periods of change, the culture outside of and within the church undergoes a dramatic shift, and the church has to respond to what is happening around it. It is no great secret that we are on the edge of another upheaval, both outside of and within the church. Institutions that gave structure and meaning to many are in decline. And the evolutionary pace of technological change is propelling us along almost at a pace faster than we can absorb the impact. It's precisely at times like this, though, that it is critical that we re-examine our practices. What of them are of the essence of the way of Christ, and what of them are simply cultural artifacts that are no longer pointing to their intended end? What has been sitting on the shelf of the church's closet for a few hundred years, just gathering dust? Why do we do what we do? Is it because we think that we've always done it this way? Or is it because by engaging in these practices, we come to know more of what is true and what is real? You may have heard a recent story about the Right Reverend Greg Rickle, who is the Episcopal Bishop of Olympia, the diocese that is roughly contiguous with the state of Washington. Earlier this past year, he caused somewhat of a stir by acknowledging in an interview that he had once counseled a family out of having their child baptized. When I read this article, I thought, finally, a kindred spirit. Now, this may be a strange confession to offer on the feast of Jesus' baptism, and I should say at the start that this is not the reason why we aren't baptizing today at All Souls. But several years ago, when I was newly ordained, I was approached by a family friend about baptizing their young child. I had recently returned from New York City to the Bay Area and was a priest at a church about an hour and a half from where they lived. Now, my first question, whenever I am asked to preside at a nodal moment, a wedding or a baptism, whether of a family member or of a friend, is this: where are you going to church? I don't ask this question on behalf of the Episcopal police, but I ask it especially in regards to baptism, because to me, this rite of Christian initiation holds little significance outside of a regularly worshiping Christian community. I have little interest in one-and-done sacraments. Our family friend then somewhat sheepishly said that they were in between churches. And I understood immediately. So my response was this: once you find the church that's the right fit for you, let's talk again, and maybe I can be a part of this with that pastor. My guess is that they still haven't found that community yet, because to this day, I don't think that their 8-year-old is baptized. Now, make no mistake, I do want their child to be baptized, but I want it to be the foundation of a growing and thriving life of faith, not just a good reason to wear the family baptismal gown. Again, why do we do what we do? In the typically spare description from Mark's gospel, the entirety of the baptism of Jesus takes place in just 3 verses. Now, most of what we heard earlier can be found in one of the other accounts of Jesus' baptism, in Matthew or Luke or John. But there's one aspect that bears our attention this morning because I believe it does point to why we actually baptize Christians year after year. In verse 10 of the first chapter of the Good News according to Mark, it reads, "And just, or immediately, as he was coming up out of the water, he," Jesus, "saw the heavens torn apart and the Spirit descending like a dove on him." The heavens torn apart. Quite dramatic, isn't it? The other two Gospels that describe this scene, Luke and Matthew, both use a different word in the Greek, anoigo, which means to open. Mark, though, in characteristic fashion, describes the scene much more viscerally because the word that Mark uses here in reference to what happens in the heavens is schizomai, schizomai. Now, you might recognize part of this word from our contemporary usage of the word schizophrenic. Schizophrenia literally means a splitting, a tearing, a rending of the mind. Mark's choice of word here cannot be overlooked, for what is happening at the moment of Jesus' baptism in the River Jordan is not tame, it is not gentle, there's no soft focus being used here. It is a breaking, an inbreaking, that will leave the world different than it was before. There will be no going back to life as it had been lived. If the barrier between heaven and earth is simply opened, as Matthew and Luke describe it, Mark makes us wonder if they will simply be closed again. But if this barrier has been rent, torn, broken open, then closing this divide will not be possible. Another reason why this word schizomai is so remarkable in this description is because it is used only one more time in the entirety of Mark's gospel. And it comes at the very end of the gospel in the 15th chapter with Jesus on the cross at the time of his death. It reads, "Then Jesus gave out a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, 'Truly this was God's Son.'" Again, the barrier between the divine and the common, the holy and the rest, is rent asunder. And again, Jesus is proclaimed as God's Son. In the breaking, what is real and what is true and what is good has been, is being, will be revealed. Several years ago, at the parish where I was serving, we reintroduced the Easter Vigil. Now, for those who haven't yet attended this Easter Eve service, I believe the Easter Vigil to quite possibly be the most potent, dramatic worship service that we engage in as Christians. I say quite possibly because there are times when we do our best to rob it of its drama and to render the remembering of salvation history impotent. And somehow this had happened at the parish I was serving, and so during an interim period, the leadership of the congregation decided to bring it back. And as part of this process, we held some evening classes about Holy Week and specifically about the Easter Vigil. During one of those classes, we showed a documentary of a remarkable Easter Vigil, and This particular vigil took place in a Roman Catholic parish in Dallas, Texas. And like everything in Texas, the church, both in population and physical structure, was huge. And one of the most striking features of this large church was its baptistry. It was sunk into the grounds, right about where our baptismal font is in the back there, at the entry to the nave, or the large worship space. The font was eight-sided to represent the eighth day of creation, or the day of the resurrection. As I say, it was big, roughly 15 feet by 15 feet. The water about 3 feet deep. The adults being baptized at this Easter vigil had been preparing for months. And in the flickering darkness, those being baptized walked down into the font and were submerged 3 times into this water. And as they emerged, the priest was handed a glass bottle of holy oil called chrism. Now, normally, priests have a very small cylindrical stock called an oil stock. And usually, priests dip the tip of their thumbs into the oil and trace the sign of the cross on a person's forehead as a symbol of the outpouring of the Spirit. Not the case at this vigil. After he had fully submerged these people underwater 3 times, and they came back up, the priest took the glass bottle and poured the holy oil all over their heads. The oil was running down their hair, and it was dripping everywhere. And then with his whole hand, not just the tip of his thumb, with his whole hand, he made the sign of the cross on their forehead and proclaimed that they were sealed by the Holy Spirit, marked as Christ's own forever. It was a remarkable Easter vigil and was captured well in this film. But after the leader of the class had shown it, there was a stunned silence in the room. And the leader then asked the assembled what they thought of the service. There was a pause, and then one of the participants spoke up. "That was nice and all," she said, "but it seemed like a little bit too much." Again, silence. Now, the French have a phrase for moments like this one, and it's called les mots d'escalier. The words of the stairs. Because so often in situations like this one, the words we are looking for are only found as we have left the uncomfortable situation and are headed down the stairs muttering to ourselves. The words of the stairs. This wasn't the case here, however. As the leader of this session amazingly had the words of the moment like I can only dream of. I still remember him saying this to this day. This happened more than a few years ago. If we truly believe that we are enacting the rites of eternity, then how much is too much? If we truly believe that we are enacting the rites of eternity, then how much is too much? Without even meaning to, friends, I think that we order and tame and control our encounters with God, baptism or otherwise, to the very point of domesticity. If there is but one lesson that we can learn from the baptism of Jesus in the Jordan and the outpouring of the Holy Spirit in Acts, it is that much like the revolution will not be televised, our God cannot, will not be domesticated. I believe that this is why Bishop Rickle and I took a somewhat uncommon tack and actually persuaded someone not to baptize their child. And it has nothing to do with the Anabaptist tradition of insisting upon adulthood or an age of reason for one's baptism. It is because we are no longer at a point in Christian history and in the world in which to be an upright citizen necessitates that one must be Christian. We do not baptize babies or adults as an eternal damnation insurance policy. Just because your parents or grandparents baptized you is not in and of itself a sufficient reason for your child to be baptized. No, we do this in the dark of night and in the deep of water with the dripping of oil because we believe that something dramatic, even quite possibly dangerous, is taking place. The barrier has broken and God is on the loose. We believe that just as heaven was torn apart, rent asunder at the Jordan, something is broken open in us at baptism. And just as with Jesus, this breaking open reveals in us a reality, an already existent truth that is always real and true, but needs to be made visible. What is revealed in these nodal moments is the truth that each of us, from the wide-eyed child to the broken and hardened adult, is beloved of God. True, real, transformative. And with that revelation, that claim of assurance of being beloved comes the call to live it, to make it known, to reveal it in a world that is so desperate to know this truth. For our gospel passage from this morning should really extend a couple of more verses. After the voice of heaven proclaims, "You are my son, the beloved, and with you I am well pleased," here are verses 12 and 13. "And the Spirit immediately drove him out into the wilderness. He was in the wilderness 40 days, tempted by Satan, and he was with the wild beasts, and the angels waited on him." In baptism, for the person and for the people, this is just the beginning. We cannot forget, friends, that when we step into these waters, we do so to be broken open in order to reveal to the world the truth of what is to come.